It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete. You haven't been beat up properly.
Last year, Cody, Kenny Omega, and the Young Bucks put together a show that sold out the Sears Center in Chicago, a little show called All In. Well, they did it again. Tickets went on sale Friday for All Out, the sequel to All In, and All Out is now sold out to the tune of about 11,000 tickets, which is all that building can really fit. The problem is, at one point, there were in excess, I guess maybe it's a good problem to have, but there were in excess of 60,000 people in queue waiting to buy tickets for this show. Now, the way the system worked, you could have had one person with multiple browser windows open, because each person's spot in line was randomly assigned, but even still, not all 60,000 of those people had browser windows open, so it's very impressive. I mean, the scalpers did. And a lot of those tickets did pop up on the secondary market immediately after. But even still, that's an impressive number of people jamming the system trying to buy tickets. They sold out in 15 minutes. So congrats to those who were able to score tickets if you are planning on attending. I was just in Chicago myself for the first time on business this past week. I didn't have nearly enough time to go exploring. So maybe one day I'll make my way back there. But thank you, Chris Jericho, I guess, right? Since AEW won't say thank you to the guy, I'll jump in with everybody else and say thank you for them. Thank you, Chris Jericho, for selling out another show. Anyway, he takes on Hangman Adam Page on that show to crown the first ever AEW World Champion. And it is now official. Not a big surprise here. Kenny Omega will challenge Jon Moxley. So the two top matches have been announced for that show. 60,000 people in queue is very impressive. Even if it was 40,000 or 50,000, it's very impressive. And I think it's pretty safe to say after, you know, these last few shows that they should run a bigger building next time. I think they have to, whatever their next big show is. May not be until next year. And it doesn't have to be a stadium, although I think Tony Khan can probably get them into one. One in particular down south. But it doesn't have to be a stadium. But I don't think they should have a problem. You know, kind of the next thing to graduate to is shooting for a 25 to 30,000 seat venue. I think that would be a healthy number of people to shoot for in the building, 25 to 30K. Look, this has become a destination trip for a lot of wrestling fans. People have shown that they are willing to pay money to travel to wherever they are and wherever StarCast plants its flag. Yeah, I know StarCast is coming back that weekend as well. And soon more companies are going to start piggybacking off the show the way that they do WrestleMania. And I think that only helps AEW. Of course, 60,000 ticket buyers is very different than 60,000 television viewers. And if that first TNT show did 60,000 viewers, they would be in panic mode. They probably wouldn't be on TNT very long. I still think they need at least 500,000 viewers to consider that first TV show a real success. You know, say they get a spot on Tuesdays in prime time, which has been the rumor, Tuesdays or Wednesdays. And I know Tuesdays they have NBA, but let's say they work it out somehow, right? Tuesdays in prime time, right now TNT has a show called Animal Kingdom in the slot that AEW would likely be in. And it's averaging about 1.2 million in viewers, at least for some of the more recent episodes. So I think 500,000 for that first show, or the initial shows, is being more than fair, even if it is a new promotion. I know it's a brand new company, takes time to grow, but they're going to have, I think, a sizable enough audience right out of the gate, because if they have that first show and the first slew of shows, and they're doing, you know, Lucha Underground numbers, which was on a horrible network compared to TNT, then they're going to be in a lot of trouble. So I'm more curious, more than anything else, come September, October, to see what they do in terms of television viewership, because it seems like a lot is really hinging on this TV deal. And that's going to really, I think, tell the tale going into next year of AEW. What is that initial audience? How many wrestling fans are there who are willing to sample this product and give them a chance? How many lapsed fans are willing to come back and even know that there's a new promotion starting up? How many old WCW fans 20 years later are like, hey, you know what? I want to check out this new wrestling promotion. There's a lot of questions about the makeup of this audience that I am very curious to see how this plays out. This is episode 604, before I forget, of the Salamonster Sounds Off here for Father's Day Sunday, June 16th, 2019. I am the Salamonster. Happy Father's Day to all the dads out there. I am not a dad myself. At least I don't think I am. I can't be sure. If Little Monster is running around out there somewhere with a PayPal account, $10 or more, and I'll give you a nickname and a shout-out. I want to say thank you to Audible. Keep supporting Audible, because when you support Audible, you support this podcast, audibletrial.com/Salamonster. We have our free trial still ongoing for those of you who have not taken advantage of it, and actually some of you who have. You might be able to try again. You get one free audiobook as part of your 30-day trial. If you cancel in that time, you get to keep the book. A lot of good books on there. Daniel Bryan, I think Stone Cold's book is on there as well. Bob Holly, Justin Roberts, I believe Jim Ross. Ton of great wrestling books on there. So definitely take advantage of that. And also don't forget to plug in that Lyft code. If you've found yourself traveling or you're going to be traveling around and you don't have a Lyft account, sign up for one. Use the code Salamonster and you can get money off your first ride. And those of you who made PayPal donations this week, I salute you. You can always do so on thesalamonster.com. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out. I want to say thank you, first of all, to Killshot Keith Hart. Now, Keith has been a fan of the podcast for many, many years. And he was being very clandestine the other week. And he's like, I have something to send you. And I said, well, what is it? They wouldn't tell me. And anyway, he had been to a convention recently, and as it turned out, I got his gift this week, which was a signed Bret Hart figure, a special, I guess, exclusive collector's edition Bret Hart 1993 King of the Ring edition figure. He's got the crown, he's got the robe, and you guys know what a big fan I am of the 93 King of the Ring. I think it's one of the best WWE pay-per-views of all time. And Bret's performance that night was fantastic. I'm a huge Bret mark anyway. So I didn't even know they had this figure, you know. And so he had Bret sign it in pink. And I've got Bret's autograph from many years ago. So I know it's the real deal. He even wrote KOTR93 on it. So anyway, very thoughtful of Keith to do that. A very cool gift. I want to say thank you to him for that. Also, thank you to John Loose Cannon Lopez for the donation. Deadpool James Herrera. The Portland pop star Paul Hamilton. The Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Luis Hercules Hernandez, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Stephen Handyman Halistick, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichert, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Recon Russell Bulware, Danger Dan Larson, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, the Blueberry Muffin, Andrew Smith, it's quite the name, and also Michael Badman Banks, want to shout him out, and his father, Paul Money in the Banks. Michael and the rest of Paul's children would like to wish him a very happy Father's Day. You can throw me in there as well. Happy Father's Day to Paul. And I also want to give a shout out to Big PPC and Wilson GTS12 on iTunes. They left very nice reviews for the show on iTunes. And I know Wilson's been listening to the podcast for about 6 years now. So thank you both for the love. We are 9 weeks out from SummerSlam in Toronto on August 11th. Last week, I began my countdown of the top 10 greatest matches in SummerSlam history with the very first TLC match from SummerSlam 2000 starting out the list. Later on in the show today, I'm going to reveal my number 9 greatest match in SummerSlam history. I suspect that some people may be upset with me this week, or maybe not. Maybe I'll be surprised. But it would be nothing short of shocking, I think, for wrestling fans to not be upset about something. So I'm sure somebody somewhere will be. We got some great wrestling this week. Let me preface all of this rage and negativity by saying that we had some great wrestling this week on WWE television. Unfortunately, none of it came on Monday Night Raw or SmackDown Live. I'm talking 205 Live. I'm talking NXT. I'm talking NXT UK, which had a really fun main event. Raw and SmackDown were garbage. But there is fun wrestling to be found, even from that company, if you look hard enough. I was swamped with work and client stuff this week and some other things I'm working on non-podcast related. So I didn't even get a chance to watch Raw or SmackDown until Thursday night. I finally was settling down on Thursday night and I said, oh, I put this off as long as I could. I have to watch this now. Because look, you know, Raw and SmackDown, this is where all the main storylines are playing themselves out. We're heading into a pay-per-view next Sunday. I have to talk about what's going on here. So finally, I said, I've got to watch this. And so I finally watched these two shows after hearing such lovely things from all of you about them. And I felt like I had just wasted 5 hours of my life. And that was with skimming through certain parts of the shows. So really, it was only probably about 3 hours or so in total. But I still felt like I had wasted 5 hours. And I know they had competition from the NBA on Monday. But it's like they just don't even try anymore. They don't even try. They're like one of us at a desk job being called into work on a Saturday. Just trying to kill time until it's time to clock out and go home. It feels like that's all they do every week these days. For all the work I'm sure the writers and everybody put into it, and the hours and hours and hours of, you know, script writing and all the other stuff they do. At the end of the day, when you see everything play out on television, or all the stuff that ultimately gets green lit, or however this works with Vince McMahon in the end, it just feels like they're just killing time. They just try to kill time until the copyright box comes on, and then they can go home, or on to the next city, or wherever it is that they're headed to next. And this week was no exception. And then I read a note in this week's Observer that WWE has gotten Monday Night Raw listed, or is going to get them listed in the category of Outstanding Structured Reality Program for Emmy Awards consideration. They are once again trying to, as they did last year, trying to get Monday Night Raw nominated for an Emmy. They are so hell-bent to get recognized as legitimate television programming. Kevin Dunn and the rest of them want their Emmy so badly, with the show as bad as it has ever been, they're trying to win an Emmy. They should try to win whatever the opposite of an Emmy is. What would that be, like a Razzie? I guess the Razzie is for movies. I don't know if they have an equivalent for bad television. May they be laughed right out of consideration. Do not reward bad behavior. For all of the work, the production that goes into the show every single week, doesn't matter. Do not reward bad behavior. I love how they'd be considered, by the way, a reality program. What reality exactly would that be? There isn't a single thing on that show that even resembles anything real. That's part of the problem. The dialogue sure doesn't. Reality program. Raw's going to win an Emmy Award. Raw's going to win an Emmy Award when I start shitting gold bricks. So I laughed when I saw that note in the newsletter this week. But let's talk about this show. Let's talk about Monday Night Raw from San Jose, California this week. No Twitter poll, because I was in another time zone. I was out at a dinner when Raw ended. I forgot that we were an hour behind in Chicago. And by the time I realized that it was no longer an Instapoll. There's a reason I call these things Instapolls. There was nothing instant about posting a poll an hour after a show's already ended. So I didn't even bother this week. I'm sure they would have been massacred. SmackDown's own Kevin Owens showed up during the opening talking segment with Seth Rollins, Baron Corbin, and Sami Zayn to show his support for all of the heels. And he ended up working the main event against Seth Rollins because wildcard rule.
Oh my God.
Lars Sullivan defeated the Lucha House Party in a quick 3-on-1 handicap match the way it should have been at Sweet Saudi Money 3. He was said to have suffered a minor knee injury. Not a big deal. Then the Observer reported that the injury may be more serious than originally thought. And they were sending Lars for an MRI. So no update yet on his status, but that doesn't sound too good. All of this stuff with Alexa Bliss and Nikki Cross, this is some of the more longer term in terms of a couple of months, storytelling they've been doing across both of these shows. And this storyline about Alexa now being best of friends with Nikki Cross, it should pay off, if I'm following this correctly as a wrestling fan. my expectation certainly would be not that Nikki Cross is going to just, you know, they're both going to end up on the dark side. I think people want to like Nikki Cross. They do like her a lot. And I think that they can really produce a big babyface, a huge babyface here in the women's division. If the payoff here is to have Alexa, you know, not even turn on her, but just have it revealed that she's been using Nikki this entire time. And she doesn't realize it, but she does in the end. I think that's how I expect this to play out. Of course, we'll see in practice if that's what happens. But that's one of the storylines now that's been playing out for a few months. And you know, the acting isn't necessarily great, but they're trying to tell a story here. So we'll see where this story goes. Ricochet, Miz, and Braun Strowman beat Samoa Joe, Bobby Lashley, and Cesaro. Cesaro hit the 630 on Cesaro. In doing so, though, he landed right on Cesaro's knee. And he immediately reacted. Cesaro did like he was in legitimate pain. He grabbed the knee and rolled out of the ring after he got pinned when the match was over. So he seems to be okay now. Looks like he dodged a bullet, but it was scary there for a bit. You know, as matches go, this was fine. But again, with these multi-man matches, they all sort of just blend together after a while. And this is the problem with having too much talent on the roster and not knowing what to do with them. You just end up with these constant multi-man matches, six-man matches, eight-man matches, or you know, you're trying to shove all these people into one match at one time. Case in point, we have a Fatal 5-Way scheduled for Raw tomorrow night, which may turn out to be a great match if they give it time. But they have a Fatal 5-Way now scheduled tomorrow night to determine a new number one contender for Samoa Joe's United States Championship. It's going to be Miz, Lashley, Ricochet, Cesaro, and Braun Strowman. And if I'm looking at that lineup, look, not that I would mind it being Ricochet and Cesaro, somehow finding both finding a way into that match and make it a three-way at the next pay-per-view. But if you got to boil it down to one person, it's got to be Ricochet. He's been racking up some victories recently, which he had to do. He was on a bad path there at the beginning. A lot of his momentum was stalled, and he had momentum even after being called up to the main roster. Him and Aleister Black, who I just... they were fine as a team and they were building momentum, but they really should have been broken off as individuals. Of course, now Aleister Black, we haven't seen him wrestle a single match on TV since. So whatever momentum he may have had has been completely stalled until he finally gets in the ring. It's like they did things ass backwards here. They were in such a rush to get these NXT guys on television before WrestleMania, which is very odd because normally you'd wait until right after WrestleMania. When you're that close to Mania, you usually wait until after to introduce new faces to TV. And they did the opposite of what they normally do and just put these two singles guys together in a completely random tag team and established them to a point on television for weeks, whatever it was, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, only to then, when they separated them, yank Aleister Black off television completely and put these vignettes together introducing us to him. And now he's kind of showing a side of his character and personality that is completely opposite of what we saw before from him. It's just the ass-backwards way of doing things. You'd run the vignettes first and then introduce him to television. And for whatever reason, because they don't know what the fuck they're doing, they did it the opposite way. Ricochet lost a few matches after that, and it was like, oh, here we go. Here we go. And then finally, he started to rack up some wins. This would be a big win for him, and I think him and Joe in a program for the U.S. title could be a lot of fun. The Raw and SmackDown Women's Champions, Becky Lynch and Bayley, teamed up against Alexa Bliss and Lacey Evans. Dana Warrior, who posted quite the tone-deaf tweet this week in support of Pride Month, which I think is a great thing, and it was done on her personal Twitter account, not the Ultimate Warrior Twitter account, where she posts things from time to time, and she could certainly tweet whatever she wants, but to do so with the Warrior face paint on, there was a huge uproar this week and a big split between people saying, leave her alone, she did nothing wrong, and then other people saying, well, it's kind of tone deaf for her to do what she did because she put the Warrior face paint on, representing a man who once ranted about how homosexuals were not as, in his words, legitimate as other human beings. When you do that, you need to expect the criticism that she got this week. It was a stupid, tone-deaf thing to do. And if she didn't expect the blowback that she got, then she's an idiot. So that's what that whole guy... And I am not angry enough about it to go on some kind of big rant. I really am not. I posted a funny meme and I got attacked. That's all I did. Like, I posted a meme on Twitter about how, you shouldn't have tweeted that. Here's why. And boy, the people that came out, again, I've really discovered that Twitter is full of morons this week. But not to the level of a few weeks ago. It wasn't quite that bad. But, and I'm not saying if you have a different opinion, you're a moron, but you should see some of the comments I got. And it's like, dude, I posted a meme. Like, don't take life so seriously. I'm not going to get bent out of shape about it. I'm just stating my opinion. So anyway, that was why Dana Warrior was in the news this week. But I brought her up. Why did I bring her up now? I brought her up because of late, Dana Warrior has apparently been working with Lacey Evans on her promos. Because remember, Dana Warrior is now part of the WWE creative team. And so among other people she may be working with, she apparently has been assigned or has taken Lacey on as a project of hers and has been helping her out with promos. And so they were in San Jose, Bayley's hometown, and so naturally Bayley was pinned here in this match. This is my, you can't see it right now, but this is my shocked face. And she was pinned. Here's the thing. So you would expect that Bayley is going to be pinned, because that's just what they do. And they don't just do it to Bayley, but they've done it to her countless times before. They go to San Jose, and maybe she's picked up some wins in her hometown. I'm not going to go back and check every single Bayley match in San Jose, but this has happened before. This is not a shock. They probably look at it as, oh, it's great heat if we beat her in her hometown. And it might be the first time you do it, but by the time you do it for the third or fourth or fifth time, I don't know that it's heat as much as you're just pissing people off. But she got pinned by Lacey Evans. Lacey Evans is the number one contender for the Raw Women's Championship. And she pinned the SmackDown Women's Champion on Monday Night Raw. Fuck this wild card rule and the horse it rode in on. Hate this fucking rule. The 24/7 stuff. Ah, finally, something I like. The 24/7 stuff on this show revolved around R-Truth being stuck in an elevator with a bunch of lower card guys and no referee. So they couldn't attack him, they couldn't pin him and try to win the belt. There's no ref. So instead, they stood around and they argued. EC3 at one point pulled out a plastic fork and teased that, you know, they may have to start cannibalizing each other. Like Pizza the Hut in Spaceballs. He ate himself. That's what EC3 should do at this point. The Iconics won a squash match, their first win in I don't even know how long. And you know, I feel like an idiot for actually thinking this company would give it 6 months before completely giving up on those women's tag team titles as being anything special. They made such a big deal about them when they were first created and what a monumental thing it was, and they got the women together and there were women crying. Oh, what a big deal these women's tag team, what a big step forward for women in this world. You would think that it was bigger than women getting the right to vote. And it wasn't even 2 months before they totally gave up on them. That's on me. I gave them more credit than they deserved. 2 months though. Hey, you know what? For them, that's impressive. That's impressive. Two giant paperweights. That is all those belts are. And then it was time for a Shane McMahon celebration. Because you see, Shane McMahon is the best in the world. Not that CM Punk guy. It's Shane McMahon. Why do you think he gets CM Punk chants every week? So Shane McMahon is the best in the world. And Raw and SmackDown both, because it could not just be contained to Monday Night Raw, you see. It had to be Raw and SmackDown. Both were the Shane McMahon show this week. Shane has been all over these shows lately. Now, maybe they're seeing something in the quarter hours that we can't see. Maybe Shane is this huge draw. And they said, well, we got to put him on TV in twice as many segments. I don't know what that says about their audience, if that's true. But I don't know. Nobody has seen those numbers other than those internally. But there's got to be a reason why we're getting so much Shane McMahon on television lately, other than the fact, of course, that his last name is McMahon. On Raw, he came to the ring with Drew McIntyre, and he was completely out of breath. There's something wrong with this guy. He's just so sweaty and out of breath from doing absolutely nothing. He cuts promos. This is before he even got physical. He was talking about Roman Reigns here, and he sounded like he could drop at any moment. It's like, dude, take a breath. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt because you know, I'll say that he was delirious when he made this comment, but let me play for you the claim that he made here on this show about Roman Reigns.
He's won the Royal Rumble twice.
Liar. Liar, liar, liar. Roman Reigns has not won the Royal Rumble twice. As if the man doesn't have enough accomplishments to his name, this company feels the need now to add ones that don't even exist. That, or we just got an early spoiler for next year's Royal Rumble. Roman Reigns has won the Royal Rumble twice. Yes, and he's been World Heavyweight Champion 24 times. He's won the King of the Ring 3 times, even though there's been no King of the Ring tournaments in the last 5 years, or however many years it's been. Let's just tack on accomplishments. Let's start a thread of all the imaginary Roman Reigns accomplishments that we didn't know about, that apparently exist. We got Drew McIntyre out there next to Shane, reciting these. I'd like to think they have him next to Shane in case Shane does drop, God forbid. He'll be there to catch him and perform CPR. So McIntyre is standing there, and they have him reciting these horrible lines. He had one about at Stomping Grounds. I can't do his accent, but at Stomping Grounds, and whoever came up with that name, by the way, should have their brains stomped on. At Stomping Grounds, I'm going to physically assault you until you are completely unrecognizable. Oh my God. What have they done to Drew McIntyre? What have they done to this guy? I guess they figure associating him with Shane will give him the rub. Maybe he'll turn on Shane eventually and go on a babyface run. But this is just horrendous. Horrendous television. I really do. I feel bad for Drew. And some people are going to say, don't feel bad for Drew. He's part of the problem. He's boring. He is boring. Right now, yeah. He's very boring. But he wasn't always that way. You know, I enjoyed his run. He didn't have a hugely long run before he got hurt, but he had a run in NXT where the people seemed to be behind him, and maybe it's a heel and a babyface thing. Maybe if he turns, it'll be like a whole new world. I don't know. But I feel like, you know, you associate him with Lashley and Corbin for so long, that trio didn't do him any favors. Now the stuff with Shane, where it's just boring. It is just boring television. And it's not good for him to be associated with all of this boring television. It doesn't do him any favors. But I could see in their mind, oh, this is going to be huge. You know, when the time is right. You know, or him just standing out there with Shane. Shane is in all these segments and he gets to be out there with him. He gets all this FaceTime on TV. This is good for Drew. No, it's not. They're doing more harm than good to this guy right now. He's going to be associated with all this. After all this celebrating, Shane introduced the Revival for their tag team title match against the Usos and Hawkins and Ryder. They cut to commercial for probably half the match. Jey Uso hit a Samoan splash on Ryder. Scott Dawson, who had tagged in and he was legal, he made the cover on Ryder while Dash Wilder held on to Jey's leg to prevent him from breaking out the pin, and thus the Revival won back the Raw tag team titles. The announcers made it a point to say that Jey did all the work, and the Revival stole the pin. So they get the belts back, which I guess means now that they go on a losing streak in non-title matches, right? That's usually how this works. We have the latest Firefly Funhouse, one of the only other, really, other than the 24/7 stuff that I've enjoyed, this really is the only other reason to bother watching this show. And you can watch the Firefly Funhouse segments on their YouTube channel, so I can see why people are tuning out in droves. But the Firefly Funhouse this week, we had Mercy the Buzzard, again, trying to eat Ramblin' Rabbit. Bray threatened to bring out the Fiend if they don't start getting along. And the two puppets cowered in fear, like he was threatening them with the fourth hour of Monday Night Raw. And Ramblin' Rabbit was about to make a confession. They kind of showed him sitting at a desk. This was like one of those cut scenes on a reality show when they look into the camera and they shit on everybody else in the house. So Ramblin' Rabbit is sitting there, and he's about to make a confession about what really happens here in the Funhouse when Bray showed up wearing a clown nose for some reason. He had a red clown nose and clown makeup on his face. He grabs Ramblin' Rabbit, he throws him down on the floor, he picks up a giant mallet, and he proceeds to smash Ramblin' Rabbit with the mallet 3 times until blood and guts spill out of this guy. And then he did a mock commercial, Bray did, for Ramblin' Rabbit's breakfast spread. This man is on drugs. And you would be too, if you had to sit through this fucking show every week. Seth Rollins wrestled Kevin Owens with Sami Zayn as the guest referee at ringside. The match was fine until the bullshit at the end. I cannot get excited about any of this. I want to. I really do. I want to be excited about this. You know, Seth Rollins is now the Universal Champion. And for so long, people complained, and I would complain sometimes about the fact that we had an absentee champion, and it's killing the show, and it's killing the product, and you've got to get that belt off Brock. It's been long enough. We got to get it on somebody full-time. And Rollins, you know, at one time, it was Rollins who was white hot. I wouldn't say Rollins is white hot. He's obviously one of the most popular babyfaces on the brand. But there was a period of time, either last summer or the summer before, him and Braun both were white hot on this brand. And it was just a question of who do you go with as your guy to get the belt off of Brock? Do you go with Braun or do you go with Rollins? Now, the idea of putting the belt on Braun is just a fucking joke. And Rollins is champion now, but there's not a lot of excitement there. He comes out, he gets a great reaction, but I don't know, it just feels like there's something missing here. And I'd love to be more excited about this because they finally got the belt off Brock. They've got it on a full-time guy. Rollins is very good. There's just something missing here. And so anyway, Rollins hit the blackout. Zayn yanked out the referee, so he couldn't make the three count. Rollins grabbed Sammy by the shirt, which led to Sammy pulling a Mr. Perfect at WrestleMania 10 on Lex Luger and disqualifying Seth for putting his hands on a WWE official. Baron Corbin comes out. You know the night is over when that happens. Baron Corbin comes out. Rollins fights him off with a chair. He hits Sammy with it instead, hits the blackout to end the show. This was a nothing show that built to a nothing pay-per-view. That is all you need to know right now about Monday Night Raw. As bad as it has ever been. And no sign of that changing anytime soon. SmackDown Live, Sacramento, California. I did get a Twitter poll up for this one. Although, looking at it, they probably shouldn't have. Over 3,700 votes, just 9% voted thumbs up. 18% thumbs down, and by far the largest percentage ever of didn't watch votes at 73% did not watch this show. And why not? It was another night of the Shane McMahon show. The first 30 minutes was all about Shane O'Mac. But what's so distressing about this, when I look at those poll numbers, SmackDown would always, and I would get comments from people saying, you know, this is, people are being biased. Why is SmackDown getting such a high thumbs up ratio? It's not that much better than Raw. This is just people voting against. Our vote for SmackDown is a vote against Raw. And I would get complaints from people every single week because SmackDown, by and large, would do very well in the poll every week. Sometimes it would be a kind of a close thumbs up, thumbs down, but it would always be more thumbs up than thumbs down. To see SmackDown sink so low as to get 9% thumbs up tells you how badly they have fucked up this show. SmackDown was a refuge for people. It was like a sanctuary. Not anymore. They opened with Shane on Miz TV, and he promised a Miz rematch. Yeah, because Miz is a loser. He lost multiple times to Shane McMahon. So Shane said he'll give him a rematch if and only if he could first get past his buddies Elias and Drew McIntyre. So he beats Elias first, a two-minute match, which is for the better. But then he falls short against Drew McIntyre. McIntyre lays him out with a Claymore kick, pins him in about 5 minutes. Shane then, seeing a fallen Miz, has a change of heart, and he graciously agrees on the spot to give Miz a rematch right now, which leads to match number 3 in this first half hour, the Miz against Shane McMahon, where Shane proceeds to lock a comical-looking triangle choke. Not that I'm some MMA enthusiast here, but watching Shane put these submission holds on other wrestlers will never not be comical to me. Puts Miz in a triangle choke and taps out the Miz in 40 seconds. Let me repeat that for those of you who may have missed this. The Miz tapped out to Shane McMahon and his crappy triangle in 40 seconds. I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say. Miz is another one. Go back many months. Much to my surprise. I won't say white hot, but very popular. has done a lot better as a babyface and has been embraced by the fans as a babyface in a way that I never thought he would be. I was wrong on that. I thought that him going babyface was going to just die a death in 2 months and he'd be right back to being a heel. And after this, he may have to go back to being a heel. It may be the only way to redeem himself after this. I know why they're doing this. I know exactly why they're doing this. They're doing it to feed Shane to Roman Reigns. I get it. But let's make one thing very clear, if it wasn't already after this segment and after this show. Babyface Miz tapping out to Shane McMahon proves one thing, which is that this company 100% does not and will not ever see Miz as a top guy. So if any of you had any illusions about Miz being a top guy, you can throw that out the fucking window right now. I saw that and was like, wow. That puts the stamp on it right there, loud and clear, where he is in the pecking order. There could be no doubt now, because they would never do that with another babyface who they saw at that top level. Never. Not in a million years. They probably wouldn't tap out at all, let alone to Shane McMahon. That sealed Miz's fate in my eyes. Now, I see rumors about Shane possibly going on to challenge Kofi Kingston for the WWE Championship. Kofi has done interviews saying, oh, I'd love that. I'd love to wrestle Shane. He said, I'd love to wrestle Vince. Kofi needs to be careful what he wishes for. Now, I don't necessarily buy this as being legitimate. It's a rumor. Somebody started a rumor, it got picked up, and all of a sudden people are freaking out. Oh my God, Shane McMahon is going to win the WWE title. I don't necessarily buy it because I do think the end game here, I hope, is Roman. But hey, maybe they use Shane as a transitional champion to get the belt off Kofi and put it on Roman Reigns. Boy, that would make people really happy. That scenario is not at all implausible. And if you want to get Reigns booed again, then hey, go ahead and do it. That's a great idea. Take the belt off Kofi, who people like, to put it on Shane, to get it onto Roman. Yeah, that'll work out well. Personally, I think that would be dog shit, which means WWE probably loves the idea. And you know, it says a lot about this company when they have so much talent, more than they know what to do with. And Shane McMahon takes up as much television time as he does. I gotta see these quarter hours. I gotta break into Titan Tower and take a look at these numbers. I can only admit they must be Attitude Era numbers that they're looking at to find some justification for putting this guy on television as often as they are. It certainly isn't reflected in the overall ratings of this show. So I'd love to know what purpose they feel this serves. You know, I liked the Shane and Miz story going into WrestleMania. I don't want people to think I'm just shitting on Shane. And, you know, I liked the story with Shane and Miz going into WrestleMania. I talked about it many times on this podcast. I know some of you didn't. I defended it because I liked how it was built up over a long period of time. And it wasn't the dominant storyline across both shows. It was one story. It was a mid-card story. It was one story kept to one show, that being SmackDown Live. And I was okay with that. And if Shane were involved in a similar story now, I don't think I'd mind it either, because the McMahon name, played out as it may be, I can see still having some value. Shane was kind of the one McMahon, other than Linda, I guess, but of the three remaining ones, Shane was the one McMahon who was not played out. He was gone for 7 years. He came back. He was as popular as anybody in the company, so it made sense to put him on television. He was the one McMahon who didn't really bother me, and I didn't feel like was being shoved down my throat every single week on television. I can't say that anymore. Boy, did they kill that. But if Shane were in a similar story now to the Miz one, a little bit lower down on the card, just on Raw, just on SmackDown, I don't know that I would mind it so much. This, though, spreading him out like fucking Ramblin' Rabbit Jam, spreading him out across both shows and doing this best-in-the-world bullshit, this I can't get behind. And it's no wonder a lot of the NXT guys are said to be looking for the exits, or at least are open to leaving when their contracts are up, and they're counting down the days. I'm sure they love it in NXT, but they're terrified of what awaits them on the main roster. A promotion, if you think about it, you go from NXT to the main roster, you're being promoted, right? A promotion is now considered a deterrent. So some big names down there could very well be looking to leave soon. Why wouldn't they be? Why wouldn't they be? When they see Shane McMahon as the focal point of their television, can you blame them? When you see how some of the other NXT talents have been used since they've been called up, can you blame them? Is it really that far-fetched to think that you've got some NXT guys down there right now who are just counting down the days until their developmental deals are up? And there are guys down there who have no name who are going to be stuck because nobody knows who they are. WWE may be the only system they've ever known, and it might be in their best interest to just stay put there down at the Performance Center and ply their craft. They've got a lot of great coaches down there. They've got this world-class multi-million dollar facility. I'm sure for a lot of those guys, it's a great place to work and hone their craft. But they've signed up a lot of big indie names who have a name, who have a profile, who I'm sure if they left and went back to the indies or went to go work for a Ring of Honor or an AEW or split their time between the US and Japan, there are guys down there who have a big enough name who could do very, very well for themselves. And if any of those names are looking for the exits, that ain't good. But they see what's going on. They're not stupid. This is their livelihoods. They see what's going on Raw. They see what's going on SmackDown. How do you think that makes them feel? We had more 24/7 wackiness with R-Truth. Carmella told Truth to go hide in one of the equipment cases in the hallway before he was spotted. But then she got called away for her match with Sonya Deville, and Truth got shipped out to LA for Raw tomorrow night. So he is trapped inside this crate on the way to the West Coast. At least that was the last update from him on Twitter 4 days ago from inside the crate. I still like the Truth stuff. I find it entertaining. He's making it work. So I'm sure in the weeks to come, Shane McMahon will win the 24/7 title just to piss everybody off. Bayley pinned Nikki Cross after the elbow off the top to at least get some steam back after losing to the number one contender for the Raw Women's title on Monday night. And New Day beat Dolph Ziggler, Kevin Owens, and Sami Zayn with Kofi hitting the Trouble in Paradise on Sami for the win. This after Dolph accidentally superkicked Sami. Makes me so sad to see SmackDown like this. It's only marginally better than Monday Night Raw, and that's not high praise. It's just a show with no soul. SmackDown had soul before, and I'm not talking about when Teddy Long was on it. SmackDown had a soul, and now that soul has been crushed. That soul has been repossessed by the Reaper. That is Monday Night Raw. Monday Night Raw, with the wild card rule, and just in general. I mean, SmackDown had an identity all of its own, and its own writing team and all that. Maybe they're mixing the writing team. Maybe it's the same people writing both shows now. I don't know. But whatever SmackDown had before, it doesn't have it anymore. And I will say that on most weeks, it is only marginally better than Raw. When for so long, we at least had SmackDown to fall back on as the more reliably entertaining of the two programs. And now I can't even say that. So with the wild card stuff, SmackDown is just Raw light, which I think is what a lot of people feared would end up happening. I saw that Chad Gable, let's get into some positive stuff here, because it's not all negative. The sky is not falling. It is not the end of days here. There is some great wrestling being offered up by WWE. It's a shame that you got to put some effort in to really find it, whether it's on the network or other places. You put on USA Network on Monday nights or Tuesday nights, you're not going to find it. But I saw that Chad Gable had made his debut on 205 Live this past week against Jack Gallagher. So I watched it. I'm still a Chad Gable fan. I have been a big Chad Gable supporter going back to his days with Jason Jordan in NXT when they were American Alpha. I've not given up on this guy. And I watched this match, and these two had an excellent match with an unfortunate ending that I actually think plays well for them, at least for one rematch, if not a series of rematches that they can now have coming out of this. It may help extend their program together after what happened here. But what happened was, Gable was outside the ring. They're having this great match. Gable's mouth is all bloodied up. He's outside the ring. Gallagher hits a tope through the ropes. Gable catches him on the way out. And he stands him up, and he hits a German suplex. And Gallagher does a full rotation. He lands right on his face. So now he's down on the ground. Gable makes it back into the ring in time, more than enough time. Referee Mike Chioda is still counting. Gallagher is doing the dramatic struggle back to his feet. Is he going to make it back in time? He gets to his feet. Referee hits 8. And Gallagher falls back down to the ground. Just flat down on the ground. And you think, well, this guy's getting counted out. All of a sudden, the ref gets to 9. Gallagher quickly gets up to his feet, tries to dive back in under the bottom rope to just beat the count. But when he goes to jump into the ring, his knee or his thigh hits the ring apron, the LED board. And he didn't get completely back in time. And the referees are trained to call it like a shoot. So Kyoto had no choice. He counted 10 and he threw the match away. He called for the bell. That was not the planned finish. The match was not supposed to end on a countout. Gallagher was trying to tell Kyoto, I made it back in time. I made it back in time. Gable's watching this. He's obviously very disappointed. They were having this kick-ass match and it has to end like this. And so Gallagher and the referee are talking. Gable goes over to the corner and he looks outside at the timekeeper, ring announcer, whoever it was. And he motions to them, give me the mic, he says. Give me the mic. He looks over at Kyoto. Kyoto's obviously getting something told to him in his ear. And Kyoto's just saying no. And Gable goes, no? And he's like, ah, come on, man. He was very disappointed. He tried to call an audible. He wanted to cut a promo. Maybe he was going to ask for 5 more minutes. But, you know, dude, you're on 205 Live. You're Chad Gable. You don't get to do that. If you're Roman Reigns, you could do that. If you're Shane McMahon, you could do that. If you're Chad Gable and Jack Gallagher, unfortunately, you don't get to do that. And it is live TV. So I have sympathy for the people running that show because they're budgeted for only so much time. They had a big main event, big Fatal 4-Way main event coming up. Sometimes you just don't have time. It is a 1-hour show. If this were Monday Night Raw, hell, let Chad Gable go ahead and call for another 50 minutes. But on this show, they weren't going to allow that to happen. So it may have been botched. Here's how I look at it, though. It sets up an immediate rematch because there was no real winner determined, and it could lead to even more matches between the two, which, after watching this one, is something I'd love to see. And I'd like to see it end with a strong win for Chad Gable. He's brand new to this brand. I think NXT would ultimately be the best destination for him. They've sent a few main roster people recently back down to NXT, including at the recent tapings. And I won't give away any spoilers here, but there were multiple names, in fact, from the main roster who showed up in NXT. And I don't know if these are permanent moves. I think the Tyler Breeze one is permanent. These other ones, I don't know if they're permanent or not. And I realize you can't just send everybody back down to NXT. But Gable, I think, would thrive there. With the talent they've got down there now for him to work with and him being a singles instead of a tag team wrestler, I think he would thrive. And he may do well for himself on 205 Live as well. Maybe he'll even end up with the championship. Maybe he'll become Cruiserweight champion at some point. Although I think his ceiling is a lot higher than just Cruiserweight champion. You may think, oh, I can't buy him as a world champion. But Chad Gable is United States champion. Seems like a perfect fit to me. I don't see why that's an impossibility. He could at least get to that level. And given the fact that they were doing absolutely nothing with this guy ever since they broke up him and Rude anyway, for him, being on 205 Live, I know it sounds like a death sentence. Some guys it is, some guys it isn't. A lot of guys it probably will be, just in terms of what their ceiling is. But for every one of those guys, you have an Ali, who got promoted to SmackDown. And he's been in some pay-per-view main events, and he's actually done pretty well for himself. Buddy Murphy has yet to really make his debut on television, but you would have to think at some point soon he will. He's been doing house show matches with Aleister Black. Aleister Black hasn't wrestled a match on TV yet since he was sort of rebooted on the main roster. If we're being set up for a Buddy Murphy-Aleister Black feud right out of the gate on TV, you know what? Sign me up. So that chapter has not yet been written for Buddy Murphy, but he's another one like Ali who I think can have big things in his future. He's way more than just a cruiserweight. So there are some guys who are going to, you know, be promoted or escape or whatever word you want to use who have the ability to go on to bigger and better things. But yes, a lot of these 205 Live guys, you know, where are they going to go? They're not all going to go to the main roster. They're not all going to get a big push no matter how talented they may be. It's just not going to happen. So for a lot of guys, it's almost like this purgatory that they're stuck in. And I hope for Gable's sake that that's not the case with him. But temporarily, for a while, for him to be able to go there and become a big star on a small brand like that, you know, look, he may end up back in NXT before long. So I stuck around when the Gable match was over. I saw they were doing a Fatal 4-Way to determine a number one contender to Tony Nese's championship at Stomping Grounds. Drew Gulak, Akira Tozawa, Oni Lorcan, and Humberto Carrillo. And Gulak also wrestled Kushida in a submission match on NXT this week, so he had quite the week. But these four had the crowd chanting 205 for this, and this is awesome. These people were loving this match. They sat through SmackDown. They sat through half an hour plus of Shane McMahon. God bless these people. Not only were they sticking around for 205 Live, but they were amped up for it. They were amped up more for this match than they were for some things on SmackDown. And I haven't really tuned into 205 Live religiously every single week, but I've not seen a crowd this amped up like this in a very long time. So it was cool to see. They were amped up, and so was I. This was a hell of a match. You pick it up here at the part where all four men are fighting out on the apron. Lorcan gets knocked off. Carrillo comes off the top rope with a missile dropkick, connects with Gulak, knocks Gulak to the floor. Gulak stumbles backwards into the barricade. Out of nowhere comes Akira Tozawa, getting a running start on the apron. He does this huge cannonball dive out onto Gulak on the floor that looked insane. Lorcan and Gulak, a few minutes later, they're having a stare down in the middle of the ring. They're exchanging chops and slaps. They're smacking the shit out of each other. People are going nuts. Lorcan then launches himself out of the ring with a plancha. He wipes out Carrillo and Tozawa. I guess he spotted them outside the ring, so he's like, hey, Drew, hold on a second. I'm going to go do this dive out over the top rope. So he wipes them out. He's standing there, and all of a sudden, Arya Daivari comes from behind. He attacks Lorcan from behind with a chair. I guess the two of them are in the middle of a feud. I'm not hip to all the storylines on this show, but that much was pretty obvious when he hit him with the chair. So now, it's a no DQ match, so the match doesn't end, but Lorcan now is pretty much out of it, right? Match continues on. The finish was Drew Gulak hitting a superplex to Tozawa, but both men, upon landing, hook each other's leg for the pin. And the referee counts, and we get a double pin. One referee raises Tozawa's arm, another referee raises Gulak's arm. Drake Maverick, the GM, comes out to ask what's going on here, what happened. That's how they went off the air. Controversy. With a disputed finish and no new number one contender crowned. So we've got one show left before Stomping Grounds. I assume it'll be Tozawa against Gulak on 205 Live this week. That's not official yet, but I assume that's the direction they're going in. And whoever wins that one goes on to challenge Tony Nese at the pay-per-view. I know I sleep on this show each week, but if the action this week is any indication of what I've been missing, I may have to try to fit this in more often. You know? I'm a Gable fan, so he might just be the guy to get me into it. We'll see. Speaking of 205 Live, this came as a shock to me. I was very surprised to read about the fact that in pro wrestling, she broke the news. Fightful.com expanded on their report that Mike and Maria Kanellis, who have been dropping subtle and in some cases not so subtle digs at WWE for months now, and Kanellis the other day was tweeting about, you know, in response to a fan, no, the company doesn't care about 205 Live, but it should, and here's why. Maria tweeting a few weeks ago, counting down how many weeks were left. We got 3 weeks left on our contracts. There were stories going back to January and February that they had asked for their releases, and they were denied. And Maria came out, and she denied that she had ever asked for her release. She never said that her husband did. But she came out, you know, denial, this is not true. Always, look, just because someone says it's not true, if enough, you know, sources that you trust and believe in, and there are certain sources and websites and people that are trustworthy, who are reliable, who get way more right than they get wrong. I think of Mike Johnson over at PW Insider. Yes, I think about Meltzer. He doesn't get everything right. But The Observer, PW Insider, Sean Ross Sapp over at Fightful, even Pro Wrestling Sheet, you know, you look at their track record, it's pretty good. And the stories were pretty consistent about them asking for their releases, even though Maria came out and denied it. Look, Killer Cross, I'm going to talk about Killer Cross here in a little bit. And he was not happy at all and came out, you know, swinging against these false stories from many weeks ago that he had asked for his release from Impact. And now he did a podcast last week and he said those reports were 100% true. and here's why I lied, and here... So again, self-preservation sometimes. You know, Dustin Rhodes came out, and he shit all over the wrestling media and websites and dirt sheets. No, not asking for my release from the company, blah, blah, blah. And then what ended up happening? He got his release from the company. But he didn't want any news to leak out and potentially jeopardize things because he was trying to time it where if he gets his release, he could go wrestle at Double or Nothing. So he was being sensitive to it. But just because somebody comes out and says, well, that's not true, you got to consider the source. I always believed that it was true. Why wouldn't it be true? Look at what they've done with Mike and Maria since they came to WWE. Look at what they've done with them recently. Only in recent weeks is Kanellis starting to be featured a little bit more, it seems like, on 205 Live. But for months and months and months, they did nothing with these people. So they would tweet their dissatisfaction, they would tweet their displeasure, and you can believe, yeah, they're probably very frustrated by their position in the company, and they probably are looking for the exits. So then this news breaks, where they have come to terms with WWE and signed multi-year deals to remain with the company each for the next 5 years. Deals that will take them through the summer of 2024. Now, I don't think the reports about them over all these months, about their unhappiness, were all BS. I believe they were unhappy. They might still be unhappy or not thrilled with their positions, but in the end, it sounds like they got two great offers that they couldn't turn down. They've got a kid now. Hey, you know, college doesn't pay for itself. Nor is a company like AEW going to take every WWE star who leaves the company. At some point, that well's going to run dry. People are going to leave WWE thinking, I'm going to cash in here. I'm going to go work for the other guys. And they're going to be in for a rude awakening. Because at some point, AEW is going to have to put the brakes on and say, we're not open for business right now. Sorry. So they did what they felt they had to do. And they may be financially secure now. But it's going to be a bad look if they continue to complain on social media about the company they work for, knowing that they just voluntarily lock themselves into what could be the last big contract of their careers. I mean, Mike is going to be just shy of 40 when his contract is up, so there may be more contracts in his future. Maria is going to be 42. I mean, the last sort of prime years in their career may well be spent under this contract here with WWE. They've committed themselves. 5 years is a long time. And if in 6 months from now or a year from now they're unhappy with their standing in the company still, they have nobody to blame but themselves. No sympathy. It's like all those times Dolph Ziggler re-signed. Dolph Ziggler's contract is coming up for renewal. Is he going to sign? Is he not going to sign? He's said to be unhappy. Or they did another Dolph Ziggler start and stop push. How many of those have we seen over the years? So every now and then we get these stories about Ziggler and his contract. And in the end, he would re-sign. And hey, maybe he is perfectly content with his position in the company. He accepts it. He's got a cushy gig, makes good money. He's got a lot of friends in the company. And WWE is letting him on his days off go do stand-up comedy and all these other things that he loves to do. So maybe it's not such a bad gig for him. But if he did have issues and he wasn't happy and he felt like I could be doing so much more, I could be a world champion and they just won't give me the chance. You know, he had plenty of chances to cut bait and go apply his craft somewhere else. And he chose not to. I have no sympathy for those who keep choosing to come back. They make their own beds. They know what they're getting into. I think Mike and Maria are the, with this deal, if this deal is as big as it's said to be, I think they're the beneficiaries of the AEW effect. A lot of lower card people in this company will be the beneficiaries of the AEW effect if their contracts are coming up soon, because WWE does not want to lose anybody. They want to keep as many people under contract as they possibly can, no matter how high or low you may be on the totem pole. Make that money now while you still can, because it may not be there a year from now, 2 years from now. It may not be there.
Let me remind you, and I think a lot of people here will agree, NXT is way better than the WWE.
We got a bunch of NXT name changes over the past couple of weeks. Most of these people haven't been on TV much, if at all, yet. But these will be their names going forward. including some names that you would recognize. For example, Trevor Lee. Trevor Lee is under contract now to WWE, and he is now going to be going by the name of Cameron Grimes. No relation to Rick Grimes or Carl Grimes. Coral. I'm trying to do it the way that Rick would say it. Coral. Come on, Coral. Coral. It's a Walking Dead joke. Anyway, ACH is now Jordan Miles. The former Samuel Shaw from Impact is now Dexter Loomis, which is funny because in Impact he had this serial killer vibe, right, going, and now his name is Dexter. Ha ha ha. I'm sure somebody was very amused by that internally. It's like Lenny Dykstra, the former New York Met, and he was in the Phillies too, right? Philadelphia Philly. Nails, as people called him. And then Kenny Dykstra in WWE. Somebody obviously was a Mets fan on the WWE writing staff, and he got stuck with that unfortunate, shitty name. Adrian Jaoud is now Arturo Rujas. Jesse Eliban is now Jesse Kamea. Luke Menzies, sounds like an MMA fighter. Luke Menzies has been named Ridge Holland, which sounds like the name of a goddamn tunnel. Eric Bugenhagen, who, if you've seen any of him, he's going to be somebody to watch. That guy's a lot of fun. The question is, again, what's his ceiling? Fun as he is, he comes out, he dances, he does this air guitar, everybody's into it. You know, is he the next Adam Rose, or could he be something way more than Adam Rose? That's the question that remains to be seen. But the guy is just oozing charisma. And Bugenhagen is a very unique name, but they've changed it. It's no longer Eric Bugenhagen. He will now be known as, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right or not, but I guess we'll find out soon enough, Rick Bugs, I guess, B-U-G-E-Z, is it Bugs? I certainly hope it's not Bugs. Rick Bugs, whatever. The guy will make it work. It's just a matter of how high can he get. Jonah Rock is now Bronson Reed, and Garza Jr., because nobody is allowed to be Jr. here in this company, he is now just Angel Garza, which I think is a fine name. So nothing horrendous, although Ridge Holland is, that's just, yeah, I don't know about that one. But we've come a long way from the days of Eli Cottonwood and Percy Watson. NXT this week, these matches were taped a month ago from the Harford Community College in Bel Air, Maryland, which explains why the show visually looked different this week. And I like that. I think they should get out on the road more often. Kushida beat Drew Gulak in a submission match. I said earlier, Gulak had a hell of a week between this and the Fatal 4-Way from 205 Live. This was a rematch from the match they had a few weeks ago, which Kushida won. Just a great back-and-forth battle that saw Kushida win with the hoverboard lock. He got the tap out. Gulak shook Kushida's hand after the match and left. And I just think, you know, matches like this and wins like this give Kushida legitimacy to a new audience that may not know him as well or may not know anything of him. I think it's important for him to rack up wins like this against guys who are viewed as legit. You know, Gulak almost has this shooter type vibe going on to him right now, at least in NXT. And I think it's good to get Kushida wins like this. I will say, for as much as 205 Live is purgatory for a lot of guys, I do like the idea of Kushida eventually moving there for a feud with Chad Gable. I feel like those two could have some kick-ass matches. Or they could just do what I would prefer, which is move Gable. Don't make Kushida move. You move Gable back to NXT and they can have a feud on NXT. Just thinking of, I keep going back to Gable, though, and all the new people they've signed that he could wrestle with. Gable and Matt Riddle. Gable and Adam Cole. Gable and Johnny Gargano. I'm telling you, the real matches for him are not on 205 Live. They're in NXT. Oney Lorcan and Danny Burch beat Kyle O'Reilly and Roderick Strong, representing the Undisputed Era with Bobby Fish's arm in a sling. Burch got a near fall, transitioned into a crossface on O'Reilly. Strong made the save. O'Reilly hit a brainbuster for a two count when Lorcan made a save of his own. That brought out Jackson Ryker from the Forgotten Sons. He was not very happy about what happened to him at TakeOver when he was beaten down. He got this pissed off scowl on his face. He beat up some officials on the outside, which distracted Kyle O'Reilly long enough for Danny Burch to roll him up for the win. So Burch and Lorcan get a big win here over Undisputed Era. Where they're going with this Jackson Ryker thing, I have no idea. They turning him babyface, I have no idea. And I've not been the biggest fan of any of the Forgotten Sons, but they've slowly but surely, as they've been involved in some big matches recently, you know, they've been able to show off more of what they can do. I still don't find them very exciting at all. But, you know, they're working hard and they're working their way up the ranks here. And Jackson Ryker, they've built him up as this monster. He just walks out and has this presence about him. So if he goes out and just destroys people, that's one way to get over. But the question is, do they want him getting over as a babyface, or is he going to remain a heel? So that was my quick overview for NXT. Now I want to scoot over to NXT UK. I did check out part of NXT UK this week. And 205 Live, I'm very proud of myself. This was the debut of a new star that I've been waiting to see. Not a new star to WWE, but somebody that was on the main roster, who they did nothing with, who they then sent back to NXT, but they sent him to the NXT UK brand. And I heard about this many weeks ago, and I've been waiting. I wanted to see how his return, how his debut here would play out. So I took an interest in watching this match, and it was Imperium, the faction of Walter, the NXT UK champion, Fabian Aichner and Marcel Bartel, who were very impressive when they were on NXT, and now they're in NXT UK. They formed this group called Imperium. They took on British Strong Style, the former UK champion Pete Dunne, Tyler Bate, and Trent Seven. So we skip ahead towards the end here. Seven hits the seven-star lariat on Bartel. We have Dunne dropping Bartel with the bitter end. Tyler Bate off the top with the spiral tap. Gets a near fall, broken up by Walter. All of a sudden, a man clad in black, a black mask, a black hoodie, covered from head to toe. I think you could see, were his hands exposed? His hands, I think, were exposed. So you can see it's a white dude. That's about the only thing you could really derive from this. Dressed in black, but clearly white. And he walks out to the ring. Nobody knows who it is. And the referee gets bumped in the middle of all the mayhem going on. So now he's down on the ground. The masked man climbs into the ring and reveals himself to be Alexander Wolf. Yes, Alexander Wolf from Sanity is now in NXT UK. He gives Bate a Liger Bomb, and that allows Bartel to cover him. The referee is revived. He gets back into the ring, and he counts the three. And people are not happy. People love British Strong Style so much that they, as happy as they may have been to see Alexander Wolf debut and get a second chance at life here, they didn't cheer and say, "You deserve it," and all this other nonsensical bullshit. They booed. They booed because the baby faces got beat, and they booed. What a concept. So Imperium picks up the win. Alexander Wolf is now the fourth member of Imperium from one faction to another. I think this is a huge upgrade for him because WWE gave up on Sanity before they even called him up to the main roster. Those guys never stood a chance. And this was coming from somebody who was never a huge Sanity fan. They never had a chance. They fucked those guys over six ways to Sunday. Killian Dane is getting a second chance soon in NXT. And it's good to see Alexander Wolf get one too here in NXT UK. Now this comes courtesy of Pro Wrestling Sheet, this next story. Killer Cross. Killer Cross is a name you may recognize from Lucha Underground. Killer Cross is a name you may recognize from Impact Wrestling. He's a man who I think is going to be a big star. I'm not alone in that opinion, obviously, but I do think that he's got much bigger things written for him in his future, far bigger than he's got right now, once he leaves Impact, whenever that may be. He gave an interview to the Wrestling Perspective podcast. Remember Petey Williams? That's his podcast. And he gave an interview to the podcast confirming an earlier PW Insider report that he initially denied, very vehemently, that he requested his release some time ago from Impact Wrestling and that he was denied. And he was not happy when that story broke and said a lot of things, and it was very unfair, I thought, to the person who broke the story. Now, of course, he says that it was 100% true, which just goes to the point I was trying to make before in the Mike and Maria stuff. Sometimes they have their own interests and their own reasons to say that something is true, or rather say that something is false, or report is false, even though it's 100% true. And there are some sources and websites and people I trust more than others when it comes to wrestling news, and people were pretty consistent about the Mike and Maria stuff. So that's just another example. But the initial story on Killer Cross claimed that he was looking for a new six-figure deal with Impact for guaranteed money. And instead, Impact counter-offered with a three-year contract for a lot less than that. This is what Killer Cross said. He said, "I will humbly say that I barely even existed to the pro wrestling world prior to Impact Wrestling. I've never asked, in my opinion, for anything that I didn't think I deserved. I didn't think I would be asking for anything I couldn't contribute back. I was led to believe that it was not available to me. If you get a job and you were told that something you're looking for is not available, and then you come to find out 6 months later that that's not true, it's been available and other people have it, you can imagine that you would be a little disparaged." Cross said that his personal circumstances have changed since he signed his initial contract. He's got a family now to support. He said, "I personally don't really need much, but it's different when you have people to take care of. Circumstances change in life. You can't anticipate it. Being told," and this was quite the quote here, "being told to go get another job by your employer, that's fucked up. You are struggling to make ends meet taking care of people, and the job you can barely afford to have tells you to go get another job so that you can keep your existing job. It's like working at a corporation and being told to go work at McDonald's. It is a weird feeling." So he asked for a raise, and Impact told him to get a second job if he felt that he wasn't making enough money. That was their response to this man. Reminds me of Jesse Neal. Remember Jesse Neal? That name from the old days of TNA. After leaving TNA, he ended up working the night shift at Walmart. Some fan walked in one day, I guess, and they recognized him. So he had to go on social media and address it because it turned into a whole big thing. He was working the night shift at Walmart, and he claimed that he was making more money at Walmart than he ever did working for TNA. Not exactly an identical situation here, but it just reminded me of that story. It's always TNA. It always feels like it's Impact whenever I hear these stories. Now, the thing to remember is that outside of WWE and AEW, and maybe Ring of Honor, a lot of these Impact talents are non-exclusive. Some might be exclusive, but a lot of them are not, meaning that they have the ability to go work indies and book their own independent shots. Even promotions like MLW that have television. Apparently, if you are one of these people in Impact, you could even go work for MLW. You know, Impact's point of view would be, you can book your own shots independent of us and make more money that way to kind of supplement the income that you're bringing in through Impact. You know, and Killer Cross says he is allowed to work independent dates, but he thinks it's only a short-term solution that could turn south if he were to get injured. So if he got a serious injury, if he needed surgery, if he was going to be out for a while and he couldn't work, because he's not making guaranteed money, so the only way to make money, you got to work. So he's just one injury, one torn muscle or broken bone away from potential disaster. He said, "I found out how much people are being paid, and I want to be paid on the same scale as that. I wasn't asking for anything that was honestly unreasonable. That's okay if the company does not agree that I am worth that. I will not take offense to that, but if they really feel that way after 1 year, if they feel I'm not worth what I'm asking, then professionally, please let me go somewhere else, and I will prove to everyone that I can draw what I am asking for." And in that same interview, he mentioned that his girlfriend, Scarlett Bordeaux, the two of them are an item, who also works for Impact, is in worse, or in a worse situation than even he is, because she's still living at home with her mom and needs a side job to support herself in order to keep doing the wrestling stuff. Now, I don't know what her situation is. I don't know what her expenses are and all that, if she's living beyond her means. I don't know. But that's according to Killer Cross. According to PW Insider, Scarlett Bordeaux did sit down with Impact officials recently to discuss the situation. Nothing as of yet has come from it. Nothing has been resolved, but they are talking. They are discussing things. They both want to work for Impact, but they want to be paid more fairly. Fairly is a relative term. What you think is fair may be different than what I think is fair. So I think it's important to keep that context as well. I think it's terrible that he thinks other people are being paid more than him who don't deserve to be paid more. It's a terrible feeling. You could probably relate to that in any job that you're in. If you're passed over for a promotion for somebody else who doesn't do half the work that you do, yeah, you're going to be pretty pissed off about that. I think it's something that a lot of people can probably relate to. So if that's what's going on here, then that sucks. But the fact is, he signed the contract. I just don't get why you would sign a long-term multi-year deal right now with Impact Wrestling. I don't get it. I mean, I guess at the time, he felt like maybe he was still a relative unknown. Impact is a brand, they have a name, they've got TV, kind of, and it sounded like a good deal to him at the time, so he put his name on the dotted line, but he signed the deal. And unlike Lucha Underground, where those people signed on for, you know, X number of seasons, and the show was never canceled, technically Lucha Underground was never canceled. It's just sort of stuck in limbo right now. And those people were effectively being held hostage. This is different. But the reality is, he signed the contract. I don't know how much time he's got left. If it's multiple years, I don't know. But he's stuck. And it's really of his own doing. But I hope it gets worked out, because he's a talented guy. He's got a great look. He speaks well. He's very articulate. I think he will go far. But it will not be with Impact. Because in Impact, you can only go so far. The exposure just is not there. It's just the nature of their TV deal right now, which is horrendous. Let us not forget, last week, they aired the wrong episode of Impact. I don't need to go down the list of things that have happened with Impact and Pursuit recently. And I don't expect anybody from Impact to come out and trash Pursuit, because that's their TV partner. Now, maybe a few years from now, if they're on another network, the truth will come out and they'll have some interesting things to say about their relationship with Pursuit. Pursuit, by the way, is either owned in part or in full by Anthem, which is just, it blows my mind that Anthem could have an ownership stake in both the network they're on and, you know, Impact Wrestling itself, and this is what's going on. So they have a horrendous television deal right now. I don't know what the exact number is in terms of the number of people they're down to every week watching that show. They put the show on Twitch, so they get some viewers that way. So I don't know what the actual Pursuit viewership is, but it's got to be minuscule. It's got to be far less than even what Lucha Underground was doing on El Rey. And El Rey is not exactly a widely accessible network. So their television deal right now is absolutely horrendous. And so him, he's only going to go so far. It's just not going to happen in Impact Wrestling. Only when he's able to leave and go somewhere else, wherever that may be, do I think he will finally strike gold, and hopefully he'll take off, because I really think he could be a big, big star.
I'm not here. Leave a message. Jerry, it's Frank Costanza. Mr. Steinbrenner is here. George is dead. Call me back.
Sad tweet this week goes to Atlant Storm, who shared a humorous, if not sad, story about the time that Vince McMahon called Dave Meltzer because he thought Lance had died. It's kind of morbid. Storm was responding to someone's tweet and mentioned that over the years, Wikipedia has announced his death two different times. And another person chimed in and said, oh, it's funny because Lance, you know, you're in that rare group of wrestlers known as least likely to die young. And that triggered a mini thread from Lance Storm talking about the time that he was on vacation when Lance Cade passed away in 2010. Storm said that at the time, he barely knew Meltzer. In the years since, he's worked for Meltzer's website, he's done podcasts with Brian Alvarez, but at the time, they barely knew each other. But he got a message from Meltzer, letting him know that Lance Cade had passed away. And Meltzer then shared a story at the time with Lance that when he got home, I guess Meltzer was out doing whatever, he got home, he checked his answering machine, and the first message was from Vince McMahon. I love this idea that Vince has, like, Meltzer's number on speed dial in case he ever needs it. And this was strange to Dave because Meltzer said it had been years since he last spoke with Vince. He and Meltzer used to talk very frequently, especially going back to the 90s. Vince talked with him. He talked with Wade Keller. I don't know if there were any other, you know, quote-unquote dirt sheet people that he used to regularly converse with. But back in the day, before Vince started, I guess, big-leaguing them when it exploded in popularity in the late 90s. But even through that Monday Night War period, I mean, Vince McMahon would have conversations with these people. Now I can't even fathom that he would even consider doing that now. But he gets this voicemail from Vince asking Dave to call him back because he had to talk to him about Lance Storm's death. Now, I can just picture, hey pal, Lance Storm died, call me back. That's why I played that Seinfeld clip. When I read the story, it immediately reminded me of that scene where George's father leaves the voicemail for Jerry telling him, yeah, Mr. Steinbrenner's here, George is dead, call me back. That's the first thing I thought of. So Meltzer sees that he has a second voicemail from Vince McMahon, left a little while after Vince left the first message, and Vince tells him in the second message, don't bother calling me back, because he realized that, in fact, it was not Lance Storm that had died, but it was Lance Cade. He got his Lances mixed up. Storm said, Dave and I wondered what it would be about my death specifically that would move Vince to need to talk to Dave. And he speculated that maybe Vince figured that if Lance Storm was dying young from drugs, the entire industry was doomed. If Lance Storm died young from drugs, then break out the body bags, because that would be a bad omen for everybody else from that era. He's got a point there. But it is fun to speculate. What did Vince McMahon want to ask Dave Meltzer about? It'd be kind of funny if he wanted to actually talk to him about something completely unrelated that, like, he didn't like in that week's Observer. And Lance dying was, like, just some random way that he felt he could, like, break the ice to reach back out to Dave after all these years. Like, you know, Lance Storm is dead, but goddammit, pal, you had the wrong quarter hours in the Observer. Like, I could picture something like that. That's just, it's high comedy to me when I even think about what that conversation could be about. But yeah, there you go. There's this week's sad tweet, sad story about the time that Vince McMahon thought Lance Storm had died. And unfortunately, well, fortunately for Lance Storm, but unfortunately it was a different Lance who had passed away. Let's take some mailbag questions. You can always email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. When you write in, David from Sacramento, California. Although I am excited for AEW becoming not just competition, but hopefully an alternative to WWE, I still have a concern. With Cody, Kenny Omega, and the Young Bucks all in a place of power within the company, I am left with an uneasy feeling watching them compete now. Not that I don't want to see them wrestle, I wanted your opinion on if these four should be rotated attractions for AEW when they debut on TNT. For example, we get 1 month of Cody leading into a pay-per-view match, and then the next month, Kenny Omega. And the only time we see all of them is their big super show like Double or Nothing. I know all four of these guys have name value, but I don't want them to get tired of the same four guys in matches over and over again. It would make them feel even more special when they have to compete. Well, I don't really understand the question. I don't see why you have to rotate those four out. That doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. If they're not working together, then what's the big deal? If Cody is feuding with this person and Kenny is feuding with that person, I agree with you that they don't have to be on the show every single week. You know, if they put a big enough roster together of diverse talent, you know, there's no need to have Kenny Omega on TNT every single week. But, I mean, especially out of the gate, you're going to want those guys to be on the show. Whatever the audience looks like for AEW, whatever that number is, they're watching in part to see those guys because those guys are the foundation of this promotion. You may not like them, but there's enough people out there who like the Bucks and Omega that they've been paying money to travel around and buy tickets to go see them. Hopefully that'll translate to TV. But to start the TNT show, and in the first few weeks of the first month or two, we're gonna hold back on putting these guys on TV, that doesn't make any sense. That's when it's most important to have them on your show. And you just have to work extra hard not to water them down and put them in multiple segments every week. Do the opposite of what WWE would probably do in the same circumstance. They drive things into the ground. Doesn't mean that you have to rotate them out and not feature them. Just feature them in a smart way. They've got enough other people on the roster that they can fill in the holes and hopefully be able to build an entertaining two-hour show out of it. But I don't think you have to rotate those guys in and out. Miles in Canton, Michigan. I've heard you mention The Chase a couple of times whenever certain baby faces are going after a championship, Johnny Gargano being the more recent example. While it is entertaining to watch them win the title in a big way, I also feel there should be some legitimacy to that title reign. I feel like the babyface should at least hold on to the belt a few months with some successful defenses, rather than lose it in their first one, with Gargano not only losing the North American title in his first defense, but the NXT title as well, To me, he doesn't seem credible enough to be keeping a singles title. Do you think there's at least some truth to my thinking where the reign should matter and it's not truly just about the chase? No, it's not just about the chase. And I've never said that it was just about the chase. I've never ever said that. I said the chase is important. It's an important storytelling device. It works best with the underdog babyface, I think. But you know what? Stone Cold was hardly an underdog. And he chased after that title too and did great business. He'd win it, and then a month or two later, he would get screwed out of it. And then he had a chase, and he had to fight off the corporation and go to WrestleMania and win back the championship. So it's a basic thing. It's been around in wrestling for decades upon decades, long even before Austin. And I think it's an effective device to use. But yes, I do think that you want to give babyfaces some credibility. And that's a good point that you make, by the way, that Gargano not only lost the NXT title in his very first defense, he lost the North American title in his very first defense as well. So other than the tag team titles that he had with Ciampa, he's not exactly had a lot of success as far as a defending champion. In fact, he's had zero success as a defending champion. He is the Sasha Banks of NXT, which I don't know if, and I'm not using that in a positive way. I like Sasha Banks, but that's not exactly what I'm talking about. So yeah, I do think you want to have your baby faces have some credibility. It's not just about the chase. I agree with you. I never said that it was just about the chase. Lem from Brooklyn. Here's a theory on Firefly Funhouse. Could the buzzard be an offshoot of Triple H with the beak, the witch as Stephanie, and the rabbit as Kevin Dunn? Firefly Funhouse and its zany environment could be a peek backstage into Bray's imagination. The Muscle Man segment with the Vince McMahon puppet and the underenthused kids from weeks past really reflect an insider view of the product. What say you? Well, I mean, look, it's fun to think that Ramblin' Rabbit is a puppet adaptation of Kevin Dunn, and we can joke about that. Until you mentioned the thing about Vince and the Muscle Man dance, I don't know that I put that part together. But that, it does make sense. That entire episode from a couple of weeks ago was all about exercise. They had the fat slob, you know, Huskus puppet, which was a knock on him when he was heavier as Husky Harris back in the day. He may have been told things internally about you got to lose weight. And so I think that whole episode probably played off of those themes and maybe things that were said to him in his time in WWE. And then the Vince puppet pops up and here he is doing the Muscle Man dance. So I think that actually is a great connection. I think that probably is exactly what he was going for. The underenthused kids, I hadn't put that together as being sort of a reflection of Monday Night Raw. Probably not, but I love it. I love the idea that it could be. And hey, if that's Bray, because I'm sure Bray has a lot of input into these things, and these segments were done a while ago. It's not like they were done last week. But if that's the idea that he was going for, if he had input into it and said, hey, we have to have these kids who are looking bored out of their minds and look like they're drugged, and it's a reflection of how boring the show is, then if he got that through, because how closely do you think Vince McMahon truly is paying attention to these Firefly Funhouse segments? He's paying attention to them, but how closely do you think he's paying attention to them? Do you think he gets all the different themes that are going on here, that Bray briefs him on every aspect of every theory, what this means and what that means? I think it would be amazing if he slipped that in there as some kind of representation of how god-awful Monday Night Raw has been without him, and did so right under Vince McMahon's nose and got that on TV. I think that would be brilliant. George from Manchester. WWE has been giving a lot of screen time to Baron Corbin, Shane McMahon, and Brock Lesnar with his Money in the Bank briefcase. If one of these three had to have a championship run from June through November, Lord help us, he says, which one of the three do you think could be the most compelling, or would you tolerate best as champion? Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar. If those are my options, if Baron Corbin, Shane McMahon, and Brock Lesnar are my options for champion, then just put the belt back on Brock Lesnar. Full-time or not, put the belt back on Brock Lesnar. At least he still has an aura about him. And whoever beats him, depending on how it's done, hopefully not a nut shot, whoever beats him, hopefully it'll really mean something and you'll get something out of it. I'm not enthusiastic about any of those three. But if I had to choose, I mean, it's like choosing, do you want to be stabbed, shot, or blinded by acid? I'm going with Brock Lesnar in that scenario. This comes from Colin. Since you talked about the Al Snow claim of Hogan versus Andre being the best match at WrestleMania 3, I figure it would be great to get your take on a shoot interview claim made by the king of shoot interviews himself, Jim Cornette. Cornette made the bold claim in an interview that wrestling is dead. His argument is that true wrestling died years ago and has been replaced by sports entertainment. What are your thoughts on this? I don't know how far back this interview goes that you're referencing, if this is a recent one, if this is from like 10 years ago. My first response is, where the hell has Jim Cornette been? He makes it sound like it's some kind of new revelation that we have this thing called sports entertainment, which has been around for many, many years now. And also, this idea that true wrestling is dead, what does that even mean? Is the brand of wrestling that he himself grew up on, old school Southern wrestling, is that what he's referring to? I mean, I need more context than this. You're not giving me enough to go on here. True wrestling died years ago. What does that mean? True wrestling means something different to everybody. How you view true wrestling is probably very different than how Jim Cornette views it. How I view it is probably different than how the next person views it. What does that even mean? True wrestling. There's a lot of great wrestling right now. I talked about some earlier on this podcast. 205 Live, NXT UK. Is he talking about the in-ring? Because the in-ring, in some ways, is better than it's ever been. Maybe not psychology-wise. But in terms of the athleticism and the moves that they are able to pull off now, and some of the matches that I've seen that, frankly, they don't have weapons, they don't have any fancy, you know, BS to them. I've seen matches on NXT UK, NXT, you know, even some from MLW when I'm able to check it out that are just great pure wrestling matches that I think somebody like Jim Cornette would love. And actually, if it wasn't MLW, he probably would love it because he works with MLW. But that's beside the point. I need to know what he means by that. That's such an open interpretation to what that even means. If he honestly believes that there's no great wrestling out there in terms of like in-ring, then he's out of his mind. Just because Joey Ryan goes around doing a bunch of dick spots doesn't mean that's what everybody is doing. If he's talking about things in more general terms, like just wrestling, it's not the way it used to be, and people don't take it seriously. We pulled the curtain back on it too much. I do find it funny, though, if that's what he's getting at, that he himself admitted on that one Viceland special about the Montreal Screwjob that he blames himself for pulling the curtain back on kayfabe and things of that nature because of his role in the whole Screwjob and conceiving of the idea. He actually blames himself for that. So is he referring to that? Because that genie left the bottle a long time ago. Didn't happen in the last 5 years, 10 years. It happened a long time ago. Social media made it worse, because now everybody's like fucking Undertakers on social media. It's just a different time. But, you know, how he would define true wrestling, I would love to know, because it's just such an open-ended term. Mike in Portland, Maine. Over the years, many people have discussed the idea of the Red Rooster. While most people tend to think it was just a rib on Terry Taylor, not meant to go anywhere, I disagree. After hearing Bruce Pritchard defend the gimmick, I think I understand what the original intent was. It seems to me they originally wanted him to be essentially what Mr. Perfect became. A young, talented, cocky guy. Cocky, I see what you did there. A young, talented, cocky guy who in his own eyes could do no wrong. The only difference is Kurt Hennig embraced it and was fantastic, while Terry just clucked and strutted. What are your thoughts? Yeah, well, Mr. Perfect didn't have fucking red spiky hair on top of his head that meant to look like a rooster. I think there's a pretty big difference there you're leaving out, Mike. I love you, Mike, but you're leaving out a pretty big fact here. This guy had red spiky hair on top of his head to make himself look like a rooster. He never stood a chance of being taken seriously. And just because Bruce Pritchard defends a lot of bullshit from back in the day. So I don't doubt that he would want to defend it because it reflects poorly on him if he had anything to do with it. Of course, he's going to defend this shit. There is no defending this shit. There is no defending this. It's like putting Dusty in polka dots. They didn't do that because, hey, this is going to really get this guy over. He got himself over. But you don't take a guy like Dusty Rhodes doing what he was doing back then. He's the common man. He's the everyman. This great baby face. And you dress him up in polka dots and a headband. There's only one intent when you do something like that. And yes, it's up to the performer to try to make it work. Dusty made it work. Had he stuck around longer and had they really put some more of a push behind him, he could have been even bigger in WWE. Dusty made it work. The Red Rooster, okay, Terry Taylor, he didn't exactly make it work. You know, good wrestler. Very good wrestler. But he was dressed like a fucking rooster. That's it. It's like Mantar. If Mantar showed up on Monday Night Raw wearing that fucking, what is that head even called? The tar head, whatever the fuck you want to call it. If he showed up on Monday Night Raw as Mantar, wearing that stupid head, and all of a sudden he's doing all these wrestling holds. He's this great wrestler. He's doing flips. Could he have made that work? I don't know. He's still fucking Mantar. Probably not. James from Glasgow, Scotland. I recently purchased a George Foreman grill. And when setting it up, my wife told me somebody in her workplace said the concept for the grill was offered to Hulk Hogan first, before George Foreman and Hogan didn't fancy it. Can you confirm this at all? That is the story that Hogan has told for years, or one of the stories anyway, one of the many, 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 many stories of various types that Hulk Hogan has told. The thing you need to remember is that it's Hulk Hogan. So whenever he tells these stories, you have to always assume he's full of shit. Nobody has ever confirmed that he was offered the grill in the first place. In fact, the inventor of the grill has done interviews, because I put lists together. I've gotten questions over the years about the various Hulk Hogan stories and lies, and I put lists together, and so I've read up on all this stuff. And the inventor of the grill has done interviews specifically mentioning the fact that he knew George Foreman and his kids were like burger freaks, and that he ate them before every fight, so he thought that he would be the perfect pitchman for it. I've never seen Hogan's name uttered from his lips once. Hogan's version of events is different depending on where and when he tells it. He's told the story that he always used to be late to pick his kids up from school. His kids were very upset about this. So one day, he decided he was going to leave early to go pick them up, and he made sure that he had plenty of snacks and candy and treats in the car waiting for them. And when he got home, he had a voicemail waiting from his agent about two kitchen appliances for him to choose from to endorse and put his name on. A grill. And some, there was one other one. I think it may have been a meatball machine. By the time he called his agent back to choose the grill, his agent said that George Foreman had already taken it. So he went with the meatball maker instead, which was a flop. I think that's the story he also told on Hogan Knows Best. But in other interviews, he said that his agent told him, hey, you know, you ought to get into putting your name on kitchen appliances and that it could be very lucrative for him. So he said, great, what do you got? And his agent said, well, there's a grill and there's a meatball maker. And Hogan said, well, let's go with the meatball maker, the Hulkamania meatball maker, brother. And when his agent asked him, well, what about the grill? Hogan said, well, just give it to your other client, which turned out to be George Foreman. And the rest is history. So there's various versions of this story. Now, mind you, Hogan has also claimed that the role of Randy the Ram in the movie The Wrestler that went to Mickey Rourke was first earmarked for him, and that they sent him the script to the movie three different times, and he turned it down because he didn't think he'd be able to give the role the credibility that it deserved. He thought the script was so good, and this character was so good, and he knew that people thought he was a shitty actor, that he didn't want to do harm to the movie. So he graciously stepped aside and said, I can't accept this, brother. You can give it to somebody else. And then ultimately it went to Mickey Rourke instead. Like, Mickey Rourke was the second choice for the role. Actually, Mickey Rourke may have been the second choice because the first person was Nicolas Cage. It was actually going to be Nicolas Cage. Well, I can't imagine how that movie would have turned out with him. But Hulk Hogan was not the first choice. He was never a choice at all for Randy the Ram in the movie The Wrestler. Even the director, Darren Aronofsky, called BS on that. He had to go on Twitter because Hogan did an interview, I think, on Howard Stern and said the same stuff. He had to go on Twitter to refute this and say Hogan was never considered for the role. Hogan is always a worker. He is always in worker mode. Always remember that.
It's time for Red Hot Action!
We are counting down what I have ranked as the 10 best SummerSlam matches of all time. This week, we are at number 9 on the list. This next match is one that I know some of you are going to agree with. Some of you may think it's not ranked high enough. And a lot of you may think it doesn't belong on here at all. That the match doesn't have any replay value. And that may be true. Although I went back and I watched it, and I enjoyed it every bit as much as I did the first time I saw it. It's not a technical masterpiece. It has a lot of dead time, frankly, between spots. But it was still exciting. Because it was unlike anything we had ever seen before in a pay-per-view main event. Especially one involving John Cena. Super Cena. As many looked at him at the time. WWE's top star for almost a decade by the time this match took place. That being John Cena. Defending the WWE World Heavyweight Championship against the man who only months earlier ended the Undertaker streak at WrestleMania. Of course, I'm talking about Brock Lesnar. Cena versus Lesnar from SummerSlam 2014 clocks in at number 9 here in this list of the greatest matches in SummerSlam history. So let's give some background first. What led to this? Brock Lesnar was gone from WWE for a very long time. In fact, he was gone for almost a decade, 8 years. And in 2012, after WrestleMania that year, he reemerged. And his very first feud, his very first target from the night he came back, the very first match he had, was against John Cena, an old foe from the Ruthless Aggression era, from that 2002-2003 period of WWE. They had at least one pay-per-view match back then. I think it was at Backlash. So they had some history together. And there's always been the question, some of people have emailed me for the mailbag, you know, what would have happened if Brock never left? Would John Cena have ascended to the heights he did and become as big as he did if Brock Lesnar would have stuck around? It's one of those what-if questions where you can't say for sure. I think Cena would have been just fine. But their careers were definitely linked in the past. So they had that match at Extreme Rules in 2012. It was, I think, a non-sanctioned match. And it was a pay-per-view main event unlike anything we had ever seen before. It was just a brutal fight where Lesnar is raining elbows down on this guy right from the opening bell. He cuts him open. We've seen him do this with Randy Orton since and other people. Cena is all bloody. Again, something that we're not used to seeing, not back at that time anyway, in WWE. You know, blade jobs, or in this case, it wasn't a blade job. I mean, he cut him open hard way, but, you know, it was unique to see blood pouring from someone's head in a WWE match. And Lesnar just destroyed this guy for the 10 or 12 minutes, however long it lasted. He destroyed this guy. And in the end, John Cena beat Brock Lesnar, which is a decision that still to this day makes me scratch my head. Especially when you go on to see what they did with Lesnar. You know, they were able to redeem this guy to a point where he was looked at as this unbeatable monster, even though he came right in and lost in his first match to John Cena, which made no sense. And for a long time, I thought to myself, you know, there's got to be some revenge here for what happened. Little did I know that 2 years later, 2.5 years later, Lesnar would avenge that loss in a very decisive way. But I thought that Extreme Rules match, even though I thought the finish sucked, I thought that was maybe the match of the year for WWE in 2012. I just really loved that match. Had me on the edge of my seat. Different than your typical WWE main event. Fast forward to 2014. Brock Lesnar, after feuding with a whole bunch of different people, including Triple H, and they traded wins back and forth. Lesnar wrestles The Undertaker at WrestleMania 30 in New Orleans. Undertaker did not look good in the match, in part because he was concussed very early on. He was dropped on his head outside the ring. And they just had a shitty match. It was a terribly plodding, slow, boring match. It was the first truly bad match that Undertaker had at WrestleMania in many, many years. You'd have to go back a long way to find a WrestleMania match as boring and dull and bad as the one that he had with Brock at WrestleMania 30. He had a great match with Punk. He had a great series of matches with Shawn Michaels. A great series of matches with Triple H. The match with Edge. The match with Batista, which was better than I think a lot of people expected it to be. I guess you'd have to go back maybe to the casket match with Mark Henry at WrestleMania 22. And this was probably worse than that. But Nobody cares the quality of the match. Nobody's going to look back years from now, oh, they had a bad match. Nobody's going to give a shit about that because of the finish, which was Brock Lesnar pinning The Undertaker and handing him his very first loss at WrestleMania. Again, a decision that I think was the wrong decision. I disagree with it to this day. But they had to do something coming out of that show to keep this guy strong because they broke the streak. You're not going to have Brock Lesnar break the streak and then job him out. So, they decided to send this guy on a tear and just destroy everybody that he was in the ring with, win the championship, and book him as strong as anybody that they have ever booked in the history of that company, is the way they booked Brock Lesnar coming out of that WrestleMania in 2014. They did not waste the streak, even though they, you know, you could disagree in breaking it, but they didn't waste his win over The Undertaker. Daniel Bryan, at that same WrestleMania show, it was the culmination of this great, you know, anti-authority story, this underdog story, and he wins the WWE World Heavyweight Championship. Two belts. We had two belts at the time. And he won both belts to close out the show, the big confetti bath. It was this great moment, one of the greatest endings to WrestleMania in a very long time. Unfortunately, that's where the storybook chapter of this part of his career came to an end. It all fell apart for him after. He got hurt. You know, Connor passed away. He was very close to Connor, and now they have Connor's cure. His father died unexpectedly. It was a horrible, horrible time, even though I think he had just gotten married. A horrible time personally for Daniel Bryan and professionally, because now he had neck problems. He had to have neck surgery, and he had to forfeit the championship. So, he forfeits the title. The title is vacant. Vacant has more reigns than anybody in wrestling history. And John Cena wins the championship in a Money in the Bank ladder match. His 15th world championship. John Cena is champion again. But his reign would be short-lived. I do believe, and this has never been confirmed, but I do believe that Daniel Bryan, had he not gotten hurt, he would have been the one falling victim to Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam that year. I believe the plan all along was to have Lesnar go in there and destroy the champion, lay waste to the champion, and if it wasn't Cena, it was going to be Bryan in that spot. He was going to be the victim of a massacre at SummerSlam. It was originally meant for him. I believe that. And he was spared by his neck injury. And the reaction to this match, I think, would have been very, very different if it were Daniel Bryan on the receiving end of those 16 German suplexes in a very one-sided affair, and not John Cena, who the fans love to hate and love to boo. The fans love Daniel Bryan. Him getting crushed in this match the way that Cena did would have made them angry and would have made Brock Lesnar, I think, the most hated man in wrestling. This is the greatest squash match in WWE history. Cena got some offense in. He had a flurry of offense here, a flurry of offense there, just to keep the people interested, keep them on their toes, make them think that, you know, he could bust out a win out of nowhere. But, I mean, the offense he got, nothing like you would expect in a world championship pay-per-view main event. This was a main event murder here on this pay-per-view. I thought that the opening was great. Cena goes right after Lesnar. As soon as the bell rings, Cena's in one corner, Brock's in the other corner. Paul Heyman's doing his thing outside the ring. Big fight feel to it. Crowd amped up. Bell rings. Cena charges in at Brock Lesnar. They start rolling around on the mat. Lesnar's laying blows into his ribs. All of a sudden, Lesnar hoists him up onto his shoulders, hits an F5. When you watch him hit the F5, the first five rows, the people leap to their feet because they think, holy shit, it's over. Now that would have been an interesting way to end that match. Cena kicks out. Brock cracks a smile. After the first F5 kick out, he stands up over Cena and he's just trash-talking Cena. That was your chance, John. That was your chance to get out of this unscathed. He goes, I'm going to kill you. It's like Sid talking to Hogan after the Rumble in 92. If you watch before they cut away to the back, he goes, I'll kill you. So he tells Cena he's going to kill him. And what follows is a combination for the next, you know, whatever, 15 minutes or so of suplexes and knee strikes to the ribs. You know, the year before Brock uttered the word Suplex City, bitch, at WrestleMania in Santa Clara, WrestleMania 31, Suplex City was not born at WrestleMania. Suplex City was born here at SummerSlam. 16 German suplexes. 17 total suplexes. There was a regular one thrown in there too, just for good measure. So technically it was 17 suplexes, but 16 Germans. Cena fights back. He had this great flurry of offense here in the middle. Brock's going for another German. Cena back elbows his way out of it. And the people are behind him. The people are actually cheering for Cena. They're behind him. Cena hits the ropes. He takes Brock down to a knee with a shot, a right hand to the face. Hits the ropes again, another shot. Hits the ropes again, and Lesnar scoops him up. Hits an F5, or goes to hit an F5. Doesn't actually hit it. But scoops him up for the F5. Place comes alive. Cena slips out. Hoists Brock up for an AA. Hits the attitude adjustment. Gets a very near fall. People are losing their minds at this point. So, again, it goes to what I was saying before. Yes, there is a lot of dead time in this match. Of Brock just standing around and sweating and waiting for Cena to get up. Hits another suplex. Stands around, waits, hits another suplex. I could see where people would watch that and go, man, that's fucking boring. But it worked. The people were into it. They weren't chanting boring. They weren't sitting on their hands. Every time Cena got a little bit of hope and a little bit of offense in, they would rise to their feet and lose their minds. Whoever put this match together and booked this match could not have done a better job at it. So now Cena's down in the corner. Lesnar's down. He mocks the Undertaker with the zombie sit-up. And he's laughing at Cena. I actually hated the fact that they were showing a replay at the time, because they love their fucking replays. So we almost missed the entire zombie sit-up and Brock laughing. They put the camera on Brock just as he was about to get back up to his feet. Thankfully, they showed a replay. They showed a replay of the zombie sit-up because the camera people, the people in the truck, almost missed it. But that was a great moment. That's just Brock Lesnar trolling people. Playing off the Undertaker win, which pissed a lot of people off. Now he's mocking the guy. Cena gets Brock later on, after many more suplexes, which frankly got uncomfortable. There were some suplexes that he folded Cena up like a friggin' accordion. Cena had neck surgery many years earlier. So he's had neck problems before, and you watch him just get folded up on some of these suplexes. It was uncomfortable to watch by number 13, 14, 15. Cena gets Brock into desperation STF, gets him down. And, of course, Lesnar is, they're trying to tease that. Is Lesnar going to tap? Is Lesnar going to tap? I mean, as if. Lesnar rolls through. He's raining blows down upon John Cena. He picks him up for an F5, hits the F5, and pins Cena clean in the middle to win the championship. And for the first time in over 10 years, over a decade, since dropping the title to Eddie Guerrero in that great match at No Way Out, Brock Lesnar is a world champion in WWE. And I love the shot of Brock. The camera followed him as soon as he got right up to his feet when the match was over and the place exploded. And the camera zoomed in on his face. He had this look on his face like, whoa, holy shit. They showed some people in the crowd. This one guy had his hands over his mouth. He was in a state of shock. He kind of looked like Sacha Baron Cohen, although I don't think it was him. They showed the reactions of some of the other audience members. You know, Paul Heyman comes in. He's bowing to Brock and he hands him both belts. JBL says that was the most dominant performance in a championship match that I've ever seen in my life. Michael Cole says it wasn't even close. So it's like the opposite of what they did, like when Cena lost to The Rock at WrestleMania the first time in Miami, right? Rock pinned him. Cena was being fancy. He went for the people's elbow. He got caught in a rock bottom and he got pinned. And so, yes, it was a very competitive match. But you could tell they wanted Michael Cole to make it very clear on commentary that, well, Cena didn't really lose to The Rock so much as he sort of beat himself. And he made a comment at one point about how, I don't even know that there was a winner and a loser here. I'm like, yeah, there was. The Rock won and John Cena lost, you fucking idiot. Such a stupid line. There was no ambiguity about this. There was no debate here. He made it very clear. It wasn't even close. They wanted, it was clearly instructed the announcers to just sell the shock of it and make it very clear that Brock Lesnar was as dominant as anybody has ever been in a title match in the history of this company. This was ballsy. on WWE's part to book the match the way they did. It was different at the time. It was fresh. Maybe not so fresh when you go back and watch it now with Brock having done suplexes in every single match since. But it was decisive. No 50-50, no even Steven. Hey, it's anyone's ball game. No. Ball game was over from the first inning, like a Mets game. It was very clear who the dominant force was in this match, and it was not John Cena. It was like Doomsday beating Superman to death in the comics. I think I even said that at the time when I did the review. That's what it reminded me of. It was like Doomsday killing Superman. And like Superman, Cena came back too, but in some ways it felt like the death of Super Cena. Not completely, I know, but it was the first time that we ever saw John Cena or any top star like him. Can you imagine Stone Cold or Bret Hart or Shawn Michaels or Hogan or Savage or anybody in their prime at their peak being manhandled like this by somebody else? You know, for all the giants that Hogan used to face back in the day, I mean, they brought in Zeus and they had Andre and Bundy and Stud and they did injury angles and stuff. But there was nobody, no babyface in the history of this company has ever gone into a match and been manhandled and just booked to be slaughtered in the way that John Cena was here. John Cena did business. They were trying to get Brock Lesnar over and capitalize on the streak. And you know what? I didn't agree with them breaking the streak, but if you were going to break the streak, they made the most of it. One fun little exercise is to hop on the YouTube machine and scan for Cena-Lesnar reaction videos to this match and just watch some of the genuine real-time reactions that people had to the match and to the finish of the match. They were convinced in some cases, oh, there's no way the match is going to end like that. And then when it did, they were pretty surprised. And in some cases, they thought it sucked. And in other cases, probably the Cena haters, they loved it. So the reaction was, I think overall, I remember this getting a pretty positive reaction, but it was still very mixed. You either really, really hated that match and really, really hated that finish, or I think you just absolutely fell in love with it and thought it was the match of the year. Or one of the matches of the year. So I tend to fall in the camp of this match on its own, when you watch it and appreciate it for what it is incredible. And they went on to book Brock like a absolute beast, which is why they call him the Beast, I guess. And he dropped the championship at WrestleMania, but he was never pinned for it, right? Seth Rollins pinned Roman Reigns, cashed in Money in the Bank. They kept Brock strong for a long time. You could argue they kept Brock strong really for the next, you know, 5 years. Probably at the expense of their roster. You do get to a point where at some point, he's got to give a little bit back here. And they probably went with Brock as the hot hand in that role, the absentee champion for far too long, to where it started to do real damage, I think, to the company. He still has value, but at some point, he's beaten everybody there is to beat. What are you doing? What are you doing to your roster here? So yeah, like the NWO was a great concept at the beginning, but by year 2, 3, 4, you've run it into the ground, you've added all these people, you've destroyed what at one time was this great concept. But in the early days of kind of this monster wrecking machine that Brock Lesnar was built to be, it was great. And so this is number 9 in the countdown of top SummerSlam matches in history. I'm sure there'll be some debate about this, especially when I put this clip up on YouTube, but I welcome all feedback. What did you think of the match? Do you agree with me that it was unique enough at that time and it was special enough and exciting enough that you would consider it to be one of the all-time great SummerSlam matches, or am I just completely out of my mind here? Because there are a lot of matches, I can't reveal what they are now, but when I get to the honorable mentions, there's going to be a lot of matches on there that I think people would expect to be on this list that I just couldn't fit in. And I actually had a different match in my original list when I first drafted this whole thing and I was trying to put this together. It's easy enough to put a list together of favorite SummerSlam matches, great SummerSlam matches. When I have to rank these things, that's when it gets a little, not even a little, that's when it really gets hard. Because it's, how do you do that? How do you say that, well, this match is definitively better than this one, and this match is it's all subjective. You know, my list is going to look very different than your list. Your list may not even have this match in the top 15. But I thought this was unique enough and special enough that it belonged on that list, even if I had to take a match off that I originally had on my first list. So next week we'll do number 8 as we count down the weeks until SummerSlam 2019, August 11th in Toronto. We're doing one match per week. Keep sending in your mailbag questions, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, if you're not already doing so, @solemonster. And hit that sub button on the YouTube channel. We're already approaching 51,000 subscribers, so thank you to everybody who got us to 50K. Now we got to get to 51, and then 60, and then 70, and so on and so forth. So that covers all of our bases here. Next weekend is Stomping Grounds, pay-per-view next Sunday. I will try, if I can, to get my predictions up in advance, maybe on the YouTube channel a couple days before. If not, I will save them for the show next week. That'll be episode 605 on the Superstation TBS. So until next time, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. Happy Father's Day again to all the dads out there. Oh, I forgot to mention one thing. So this Friday is Toy Story 4 is coming out, but there's another movie coming out. It is this reboot of Child's Play. And I don't even know why they bothered rebooting it. The original is a timeless classic if you're into those types of horror movies. It's a great movie. There was no need for them to do this. But I watched the trailer, and I'm a Child's Play fan. I'm a Chucky fan. So, of course, I'm going to see it. So now my only debate, my internal debate here is, which movie do I see first? I can't see them back to back. I'll fall asleep. But which movie do I see on Friday? Because they both come out on the same night. I figure it's going to be a shit show trying to get into Toy Story. So I may see Child's Play. But I do intend to see both movies, and if and when I do, I will try not to give any spoilers out, but I will give my quick review here on the show. Maybe next weekend, if I've seen one of them or both of them, I'll talk about that next week. But yeah, I'm very excited. Two movies I like. I don't go to the movies very often. And now I have two movies coming out on the same night that I have to choose from. Tough decisions here. Take care, guys.
The Solemonster sounds off.
Should WrestleMania be expanded to 2 days? Is it time for a 2-day WrestleMania? Fuck no, that's not what needs to be done. We didn't need a 2-day WrestleMania the first 30 years. We sure as fuck don't need one now.
The Solemonster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, and more.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolemonster for sound off extras and more. And follow the Solemonster on Twitter @Solemonster.
Solemonster.
Solemonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solemonster sounds off.